The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello, you are listening to Premier Christian Radio. You've joined me, Sam Hales, for The Profile this afternoon. And if I'm sounding a little bit different, that's because our country is in really unprecedented times. A matter of days ago, it was told that really everyone in the country should be taking social distancing measures because of the coronavirus. And so rather than joining you from our usual radio studios in central London, I'm recording this from home, but we still have a guest for you this week. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined by the author and broadcaster, Ridian Brooke. Ridian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We've got to start with the kind of time that we're living in, really. You were just saying before we came on air that you've brought out a new book we're going to be talking about called God Bothering, and you were just joking that this is the worst time to be bringing out a book because presumably this makes publicity pretty difficult. But what are your reflections on a moment of history, really, that I think no one was really anticipating?
Well, actually, I did the Thought for the Day about 4 weeks ago. The last one I did on coronavirus, I talked about the young doctor in Wuhan who died. And at that point, it was a sort of ripple rather than a wave, which it is now. I actually drew on Albert Camus' The Plague, talking about how a pandemic can affect society and the way that people respond to it. And it goes through various stages of ever more pessimistic in Camus' depiction. I still think we're probably in early days. I mean, obviously we're at the bottom of this curve of something quite serious. And it feels like a sort of phony war at the moment. I think a lot of us are having phantom symptoms, little coughs and obviously some people have it and some people have already lost their lives. So it's trying to get this balance between the seriousness of what we're engaging with and keeping light on light if you can, not giving into fear, I guess. It's that balance between, I guess you could call it fear and faith.
Mm. Yes. Well, here on the show, we normally start with a person's life growing up. But actually, I noticed that your own story and your entry into doing what you do now, which is writing, began when you were actually struck down with a viral condition yourself, weren't you? So should we start there?
Yeah, I was in my mid-20s. I had a post-viral condition as a consequence of something I picked up in the West Indies. And it took me out of work actually for a couple of years. I was really ill for a few months and slowly recovered. Two things happened to me during that time. One, I came to faith, and two, I actually started to write. So faith and writing have always gone together for me. And I guess I changed from, I guess being some, I describe myself as a sort of a hedonist, I guess. Not a thinking atheist or even a thinking agnostic. I just was enjoying life. And that got paused. And I was confronted with my immortality and confronted with new ways of seeing the world. Mm. And out of that, I became a writer.
So was it that sense of being very unwell that caused you to think about the big picture of, is there a God and what's going to happen when I die and all those sorts of big questions?
Yes. I mean, I'd say just before I made a decision, if you like, of faith, circumstances had gone awry. This was before I was ill, really. Just, I guess, a crisis of my relationship, which led to a sort of questioning of what I wanted and who I was. I went traveling on my own, which you should never really do if you're feeling a bit morbid. I took with me a Bible, actually, that my then girlfriend and now wife, Nicola, gave to me. I took it as a lucky talisman. I didn't intend to read it. I just thought it would kind of protect me in some strange way. But I did start reading it when I was traveling. I read two of the Gospels, and I was struck. Actually, I was more than struck. I was quite angry, actually, that no one had told me about this stuff, even though, of course, they had told me. I just hadn't been listening. you know, it was dynamite what I read. And also, strangely speaking to some of my anxiety around, you know, I guess the big questions, you know, the first order questions, why are we here? What happens when we die? And why is there something and not nothing? Things that I had thought about when I was younger, but not pursued in any depth. So that combination of beginning to look into faith and being struck down by illness sort of led to where I am now.
Was there a particular moment where you'd say you became a Christian, or was this a kind of gradual process for you?
Well, I described my conversion as fairly dramatic because it seemed quick, but I'd love to be able to write, and maybe I will, about the nature of conversion and what happens and when and what exactly is happening. And is it a sort of intellectual ascent, an emotional ascent? Is it something completely supernatural? I don't fully know the answer to that. All I know is that I went from being in a state of suspension to decision, which obviously was an intellectual decision, but it was a heart decision to say yes to the things that I'd been reading, I guess, in the gospel. Not really kind of looking back from that moment. I mean, I did meet people of faith who were there at a particular moment when I was ill. When I was in Trinidad, I actually was looked after when I was ill by this couple who were called Horace and Salome. Bless them, I've not met them since, but they ran the guest house where I was staying. I'd had a very bad experience with some drugs. I wasn't really a big drug taker, but I had a terrible adverse reaction to smoking some Sensimilia, which is a very strong weed. And it was like a perfect storm of events, really. And then the week that they looked after me, they took me to church every day where they had a visiting preacher from Alabama, a real hellfire preacher. He wasn't really what I wanted, but it was more looking at them and seeing they were so kind to me. And I realized that they believed the things that I've been reading in those gospels. They took them seriously. And I wanted that for myself and took a decision that it was something I wanted, and it was saying yes to what was there. I mean, that all sounds very kind of neat, but it wasn't so neat in the process. But that was a key week, and I guess there was a key day when I said yes. Yeah. But the process of faith was ongoing from there, and a deepening commitment was experienced from that day on.
And you talk about saying yes to kind of what you were reading in the Gospels. At the time, what did you understand that to mean? Because I'd love to come on and talk about faith now and how your faith might look different. But at the time, what did you feel like you were saying yes to as you were reading the gospel?
Well, I was essentially saying yes to the God as found in Jesus. And that when I read the gospels, he was leaping out at me, you know, speaking to me. And I thought, who is this figure? You know, I knew of this figure culturally. You know, I'd been around church. I even got confirmed when I was young, so I knew the stories, but I just didn't take it seriously, and I hadn't taken him seriously. And then I was confronted by this figure who was saying things. It was an either or moment, really. It was like, this person is either who the gospels are saying he is, and perhaps who he is saying he is, or he isn't. And I chose to believe that he is, and was, and is. So that's what I was saying yes to. I didn't really know what the package was. Yeah. It wasn't like I signed a form or even said the prayer. It was a yes. It was a sort of deep, profound yes. And in a way, I then discovered what I said yes to, having said yes to it. There's that great quote from Augustine, which is, I believe in order that I might understand, which is sort of flipping round the more common Western Enlightenment view, which is, of course, you have to understand in order to believe. And that has been the experience of faith for me, is that saying yes opened a whole set of doors, I guess, to a deeper and richer experience of who God is.
So tell me, what does faith look like now? How does faith look different to what it was when you first said yes? Has it looked the same perhaps as well?
I think when I first came to faith, there was a huge sort of enthusiasm, and I was probably deeply irritating at the beginning because you want to tell everybody about it.
A lot of people say that. It's quite funny. When I ask this same question to other people, they quite often say I was a bit full on to begin with.
Actually, the thing is that a lot of people had known me before I came to faith in my mid-20s, and there was a slight fear around what had happened to me, which I could detect in them. And I think I probably had a bit of that fear myself, is what have I got myself into? But I couldn't get myself out of it. Arguments didn't persuade me out of it. And I didn't feel I could walk away. I think over the years, you learn. If it's a relationship, which I think it is, it's a deepening and a greater understanding, and hopefully a greater love comes with that for God and for other people. I mean, doctrinally, probably some of my positions might have changed, but the essence of what I believe hasn't changed. And the way I've communicated about faith has probably changed a bit over the years. Mm. It's been interesting, having this book called Bothering, which is really a collection of 20 years worth of thought for the days, seeing how have my thoughts changed or have they? And I can see a through line really from the beginning, which hasn't changed. Some of the things that I think I probably still think. Some of the practice might be different. And the way I talk about faith has perhaps got, I wasn't going to say more sophisticated, but you get cuter, I guess, with it, especially in the world that I'm in. I mean, I'm a novelist, I'm a script writer. I'm in a world that is certainly sometimes ignorant and often hostile to issues of faith. So I've had to learn to find a way to use words carefully and as thoughtfully as I can, and to connect with a world that doesn't share what I believe.
I'd love to talk a bit about that and about language, which I find really interesting, because are there even certain words that you might be comfortable saying to someone in church on a Sunday, but you would never use in your kind of working environment because it's alienating and people don't understand, or people have a perception of what certain words like Christian would even mean, or church for that matter?
Yes, I think over the years I've tried to not have that dichotomy, if you like. It's about the integrity of using the same language with people of faith and people of not of faith is quite helpful if you can keep it. There are certain understandings that you have with when you meet with people of faith, certain expressions that probably would sound a bit odd if you were with someone who didn't share that faith. There's an intimate, I guess you could say, love language almost around faith, which you'd be wise not to use around other people who don't share your faith. So I think you have to be careful in that way. There's a lot of jargon in faith and in churchianity. I don't like that. I try not to use it. Any religiosity sets off alarm bells for me. So I know it sets off alarm bells for others. So I'm hot on that in my own use of language, if I can be. Thought for the day obviously poses a very particular challenge. You're speaking to 5-6 million people. I mean, what percentage of those have a faith that they share with you? Must be less than 10%, if not less than that, over the years. So you have to be careful with the way you use words. I mean, Christianity is it's a faith in the Word. Jesus is the Word. So part of that makes me think, well, words are important, and the way we use them, and we have to be wise about how we use them. And I work with words, of course, on the page and verbally. So I take words seriously. I don't go around using the phrase washed in the blood of the Lamb, but then I never did use that phrase because that doesn't mean anything to people. Perhaps it did 100 years ago, And I understand what it means theologically, but it's not a helpful phrase.
Yes, it's not the sort of thing that's going to be helpful, especially if you say it on Radio 4 during Thought for the Day. Like you say, it's going to just completely alienate people. So tell me more about what I think is one of the most fascinating roles there are in the country, right? I mean, you've got, like you say, a huge audience. You've got a very short period of time to say something helpful, even profound, but not in a twee way and not in a way that's going to alienate a group of people who might completely disagree with you. I mean, this sounds like, in one sense, an incredible opportunity, and in another sense, an almost impossible puzzle to try and put together.
Well, the introduction to my collection of thoughts, I've just written a précis, really, of what the remit is. Shall I read it to you? You've got a day to write 500 words about something in the news through the prism of your faith, but don't preach. You must not say anything that might offend. Make sure the words contain enough theology to satisfy the remit. Stay true to your faith while remembering that the vast majority of people out there don't share it. There is no we on Thought for the Day. Don't be platitudinous. Be original. Write as though addressing one person, but deliver them to 6 million. You'll be live on Radio 4 in the middle of the most influential political news program in the country. Read it in under 3 minutes, ideally 2 minutes, 45 seconds. Be ready for feedback. Expect criticism, maybe even hostility. You'll get paid £90 a pop. Don't give up the day job. I mean, that's a sort of my own sort of take on what the brief is. I think Thought for the Day is a very, I call it the daily anomaly. You know, it shouldn't be there really, but it is. And in a way, I shouldn't be on that program. I'm not a professional minister from any, you know, I thought it was just bishops and rabbis who did it when I started. So I found myself doing something that was, had this huge exposure. I didn't fully appreciate that even when I started. I think I can say this now after 20 years of doing it. I realized that after a while there were sort of three groups of people, if you like. There were the people who were very hostile to it because of their worldview, atheist or agnostic. There are the religious people who are never satisfied and you can never please, and probably they're a tougher crowd than the former crowd. And then there are just the sort of the weary and the wary and the tired and the knackered, which is really most of us, if not all of us. And I try to think of those people because it's going out at that time of day where people are cranking through the gears, showering, shaving, eating breakfast, or maybe on the train. And you know that a lot of people just are vaguely catching what you're saying. Some are switching you off. Some are swearing at you. Others are tuning in because they want to hear. But I try and keep those people in mind because I'm thinking, I've got a little bit of a moment to say something hopefully helpful. Over the years, I think I've become more pastoral with them. I'm more aware of that role that thought has in the nation's day. I choose my subjects according to the contingencies of what's happening in the day, you know, in the week. So I may have a thought about a particular issue that can chime with something in, you know, on the Wednesday that I'm doing it or the Thursday that I'm doing it. But you have to be fairly flexible with what the subject matter is. They'd like you to be obviously topical. And by and large, I've usually written the thought I want to write and not felt any kind of pressure to change it. Or you have to be careful not to be seditious. You have to be careful not to offend. You obviously have to be, as I say, not platitudinous. You've got the BBC's remit. You've got, you know, the live element. There are a lot of little things coming at you when you're doing it, and it's a very tough little construction. 3 minutes, it's not very long, but it is a very particular form, sui generis, really. I've talked to my dear friend Richard Harris, who's been Bishop Harris, who's been doing it longer than anybody. He's a neighbor, and we, you know, he's the only one of the few people I can meet and talk to about doing Thought for the Day, and yeah, we agree. And you know, he is also a man of letters. That it's its own form. It's not a sermon. It's not a homily. It's not a poem. It's not an essay. it's own thing. And after a while, I got used to that and enjoy and sort of embrace that element of it.
Have you ever been edited? By which I mean, have you ever come along with a thought or submitted it beforehand and been told, actually, no, that doesn't fit. You know, you can't really say that kind of thing.
You have a producer who's steering you through the day and hopefully steering you away from the rocks. And actually, generally, they've done a great job with that, especially at the beginning, you know, apparently when I was heading for the rocks a bit more frequently than I do later, now that I'm older and uglier.
What were those sorts of things?
Well, they would never be, there would often be a tone thing and a thing about assumption about what you can and can't say, or prefixing a sentence with a maybe or a perhaps rather than a sort of state of certainty. I mean, things like that are generally, that's the kind of editing we're talking about. I mean, you decide the subject matter in the morning and you agree on, you know, I'm going to do this and this is what I think I'm going to say about it. And then you read it. That's at 9 o'clock in the morning, the day before you're doing it. At about three, I've got quicker over the years, but usually now by about three, I'm reading into them first draft. And that's when we discover if it's working or not, really. And I'm really grateful to all the producers, actually. Christy Morgan, who is head of religion at Thought for the Day, is a wonderful midwife to hundreds of thousands of thoughts, and has a very good ear, I think. She says this thing to me, which is really helpful, which is people don't hear what you're writing. You may think that's what they're hearing, but they're hearing something else. And she's got a good ear for what she thinks people are actually going to hear when you say something.
Did that present any challenges when you've... Because for this latest collection, as you say, God Bothering, it's moving it from audio to written because it's a book. So it's taking words that were spoken and you've now turned them into a book. Did that actually present any difficulties? Have you had to go back through an edit to think, actually, this it's going to work differently in print than if you heard it?
Well, to be honest, no, because I'm a writer, I really craft my thoughts. I work them to death and rewrite them. That's I guess what I do. So most of them read fairly well. Although I say it myself, I mean, this book contains my best. You know, I've done 250, I think, and it contains my sort of hopefully my best 125. So I write to be read as well as to read out loud. Mm. Some who do thought have a much more breezy approach to the written side of it and deliver it in a way that feels more spoken and natural and less read from the page. Mm. And I think everyone's slightly different in the way they do those things. Mm. So actually, when it came to editing, it was more actually a flow. I mean, my punctuation was different when I wrote them because I would write a certain kind of pause for my own benefit, and so we had to change some of the punctuation from my script punctuation, if you like, which just enabled my delivery. I did choose words for sound sometimes, and often when you read a thought to yourself, you go, I can't use too much alliteration, or you realize you used a certain word like interesting too much. You know, I use the word interesting a lot in conversation, and it kind of finds its way into my thoughts. So that's really the editing, and I've had a few ding dongs, but healthy ding dongs. You know, with producers, nothing that's upset me, nothing that's left me thinking, you know, my freedom of expression is, you know, being restricted. I do have nothing but praise for them, and that's quite genuine, really.
Now, interestingly, Thought for the Day has its critics because, and people may not necessarily know this or understand this, but it's not produced by the Today programme. It's produced by the religious department at the BBC. And so you have this section that's almost parachuted into an existing programme. And of course, Today presenters themselves, some of them have been quite critical of the slot that's kind of within their own show. What's your take on that? I mean, especially if you're sitting there reading a thought, what's John, you know, in the past, John Humphreys, is he looking at you? Is he engaging with it? Is he uninterested? Does he wish you weren't there? What's the kind of vibe in the studio?
The vibe for me is generally being good. I remember the very first day I did my thought, it was John Humphreys and James Naughtie, and I was incredibly nervous, and they were really kind to me. They got me through it. what people don't realize is how busy these guys are when they're doing today. All the presenters are, they've got headsets on, they've got producers firing things into their ears, they've got tape segments, they've got segments where they're having to interview people. Some of it's written, some of it's unscripted. Then they've got to introduce me. I've noticed sometimes that they do listen to the thought. Sometimes you know that they're panicking about what they've got next, and they're using thought as a literally as a pause for them to gather, to gain breath, if you like. And I've you know, fond thoughts about the presenters of today over the years. John Hatchie has been very particularly kind to me. One occasion, I did a thought for the day, and he got out and he walked out of the box with me and thanked me for doing that thought. He has his own view, perhaps, about the slot and its sort of faith nature, but he's entitled to that. You know, I disagree with him on his view on that. Although a little bit of me actually would quite like there to be humanists, atheists. In the slot, just to hear what they would do with the 3 minutes and what they would say and who they would quote and what they would leave us with. You know, the platitudinous element of thought for the day isn't anything to do with faith, actually. It can be, but it's actually just to do with the fact that people actually can be quite platitudinous, irrespective of what they believe. So it would be interesting. You know, I'm kind of, personally, I'm game and open to that as a prospect. And yet, I also think it's such a rare thing to have this faith perspective in a show like that. Why not? It's only 3 minutes. It's not as though the others don't have a voice.
Premier Christianity Magazine.
Are you fed up with fake news or bored of bad stories? We think it's time for something different. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. Every month, our team publishes stories of lives transformed, testimonies, miracles, healings, and loads more good news. We're here to encourage you, excite you, and keep you up to date with all that God is doing through His church. That's why we're proud to bring you a magazine that's different.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. We're bringing this edition of the show to you from my spare room, as it happens. Of course, along with the rest of the country, we are in lockdown. Most of us at Premier are working from home. But we've still managed to put together this interview for you. It's with Ridian Brooke. He's a Thought for the Day contributor. He's got a new book out now, published by SPCK. It's called God Bothering, and it's a collection of his thoughts on Thought for the Day. In this interview, we've been talking about Ridian's life growing up, how he became a Christian, and there's loads more still to come. So without any further ado, let's listen in to the rest of my conversation with Ridian Brooke.
What is the ideal piece of feedback that you would have from someone listening to your Thought for the Day? Either a piece of feedback you have received or a piece of feedback that you would love to receive. What's the kind of ideal for you in walking away from the studio and someone saying that thought did this, or you know, what is the ideal piece of feedback that you would love to hear?
Well, the nature of the feedback, the medium has changed, because of course back in the day you'd get a letter, you know, forwarded to the BBC and then forwarded to you 2 or 3 months later, and they were often more elderly people who would write to you, sometimes correcting you on your use of scripture, often kindly, occasionally green ink. Then Twitter and social media happens and people get back to you very quickly. I generally positively. In terms of the sort of ideal, I mean, I'll give you an example. I did one on dementia quite recently, actually. And I had the most incredibly moving response to the thought from someone who was not a believer, but as a consequence of hearing my thought, got in touch with their mother who had dementia, who they'd not seen for 10, 15 years, yeah, and went to meet them and read them my thought. So that was incredibly powerful, because it's one thing to me to sort of encourage the faithful and sing, you know, preach to the choir, but to touch people who maybe are not on the same page and yet affect change, that's powerful. And over the years, you know, I've had, you know, definitely more kind responses. I mean, I've had some fairly unpleasant ones, I have to say, and a couple I've had to deal with almost legally because they were so unpleasant. I did once have a response which was interesting. There's a rule which is, you know, don't engage if someone writes to you in a threatening way. And I had one, I don't know if you remember, but 10 years ago, there was an American called Stephen Hill who was sent to prison for attacking and killing someone in an abortion clinic. He killed a doctor and he was sentenced to death at the electric chair. And I did a thought for today, which was really questioning his, because he talked about doing God's will and reading the Bible. And I just questioned what Bible he was reading. And it was about what Bible do we read? And what, you know, what, how literally or not do we take scripture? A few weeks later, I got an email actually from his best friend. And at this point, Stephen Hill had been executed. And he was very, very angry with me, understandably, although he hadn't really heard quite what I'd said. And my wife said, don't respond to that. That's a no-no. But I felt really sure I should. And I wrote a letter to him just saying that I was sorry, you know, about his friend being executed and sorry about what he'd interpreted from my thought and phrased again what I thought I wanted to say and was trying to say. And he actually wrote back a very conciliatory letter thanking me and apologizing himself for the sort of threatening language that he'd used. And I had a little bit of a dialogue with him for a few more weeks after that. I haven't kept that up. So that was an interesting experience, really. I'm not sure I should do that every time or could afford to do that every time, but it felt like a moment where I should do it, at least in that occasion.
Yeah. We haven't talked much about church yet. I'd love to hear what that word means to you. Do you have a local church? Have you found yourself fitting in a particular denomination, or is your faith expressed sort of outside of that traditional construct, if you like?
Well, I came to faith, you know, the back of the Jeep in Trinidad, outside in the fresh air. And sort of once I made that decision, obviously was drawn to the faithful and to a place of worship and a fellowship. Initially, it was a very elderly church. It was Pentecostal, actually. My wife, background. So I'd grown up nominal, I guess, Church of England. So that was a novel experience for me, that form of worship and that approach to church experience. We then found ourselves when we got married in the Vineyard Church, and which was a sort of charismatic evangelical experience, which we loved and enjoyed and received great teaching and a lot of healing, and it was a great experience. And then we had this trip to Africa with the Salvation Army in 2006, which sort of slightly ruined us really in terms of our understanding of church, or just changed and challenged us, I think. That's another story in itself, but I think what we saw there was a church forced to get out of the building because of a pandemic. In this case, it was HIV, AIDS. And that very often we expect people to come to church, but actually the church really should be going out. And when we came back to our own community, we just felt, in a way, we just wanted to be more available to our community, not to our church, which was slightly taking us out of our community into something good and worthwhile, but it wasn't here. So we sort of went a bit loosey-goosey and did the home church thing with some like-minded people. We weren't part of any formal denomination, and I guess we still aren't. We have lots of homes, All Saints Church in Sheen, and we can pop into the Vineyard or, you know, get our smells and bells up the road of St. Michael's. We're fairly ecumenical in that respect. I have a men's prayer group, which I've been part of for 20 years, which is a mixed bunch of guys. We meet in our houses. And I do a pub group for men who don't want to go to church once a month. So I feel connected in terms of a body of believers. And I think really, I don't think there's any one way to do church, is my answer. There's no one right way. And when people start saying there's a right way, I run a mile, you know, because there clearly isn't a right way. I think there's right practice and there's right sort of attitude and right heart attitude. But yeah, and that's still a journey I'm on. I'm not saying I'm doing it right, vicar. I take seriously Jesus's words about where one or two are gathered. And I take seriously the idea of the priesthood, Paul's idea of the priesthood of all believers.
I wonder,
so if you took those two, they would be quite foundational for me.
Sure. I wonder if the kind of, if I can call it church expression that you're describing, the more kind of home church, almost doing church, who don't want to go to church. I wonder if those kinds of church are actually becoming more and more common and more popular, because the statistics seem to suggest that those people certainly turning up to a traditional Church of England service, the numbers of people attending those kind of services are very clearly on the downward trend. And it's not just the Church of England, but in general, the numbers seem to be struggling. Whereas you do hear more and more people say, well, you know, I'm not part of any church, but I'm still spiritual, or I'm still religious, or I still, or even some of the things you've said, I still believe in meeting together, and I still believe in the priesthood of all believers. And do you have any thoughts on that, or whether we might be seeing quite a significant shift in the way people, not just Christians, but people in general, think about religious gatherings, and how it does seem to be moving away from some of the more structured and more traditional ways of doing church?
I think people outside of the church, and I mean the church in its broadest sense, don't really care about this stuff. When they do think about it, I think they think of the church as the Church of England broadly, or Catholic. Thought for the Day is very Anglican, really. BBC is very Anglican if it was going to pick a church. So I never feel quite that I belong in that sense. I think there's room for both, and I would hope that we keep both and that both will be maintained. There may be a movement of numbers. It's interesting now what's happening in this pandemic that we're experiencing now, because obviously churches are having to close and home churches are having to stop, and people are going to have to draw on their own resources and remind themselves of what it is they believe and not be, I mean, obviously we're a body, but we can't be the audience anymore. You know, we're not just, you know, we're either the body or we're not. People are going to have to find some new things about themselves and what they believe. And that I think will be good. Mm. You know, there are churches around the world who can't meet for political reasons.
Yeah.
You know, you think of China, but there are other countries too. And that's a really interesting area, because that suggests people are doing it because they want to, not because they have to, or even because it's culturally what you should do. So I think church sort of analysts and statisticians, you know, probably love analyzing, looking at these things, but I think there will always be a body, you know. It'll just maybe take different shapes and forms.
Yes.
And sometimes it'll be more obvious and visible to the world, and sometimes it'll be underground, hidden, you know. There's a lot of good things happening that don't get noticed in life, and a lot of faith activity is hidden, and, you know, small acts of kindness, whether by people of faith or not, are, you know, that's an interesting example of faith in action, really, or God in action.
Now, obviously, if you were to go on Thought for the Day, which I know you wouldn't do, but if you were to go on Thought for the Day and take the microphone and say, right, listen up, everyone, Jesus is Lord, you need to bow the knee and worship him and turn away from all your idols, you'd get cut off, quite, and rightly so. So But the reason I ask this question is you already mentioned you've been part of a Vineyard, which is a more evangelical expression of church. And so I appreciate the word evangelical and evangelism are different. But even so, to talk about evangelism specifically, it's not going on the radio and shouting at people for sure. But what are your thoughts on that more generally, just living as a Christian, of how we share our faith in a natural, normal, relevant way in the society we find ourselves, a society that can be quite sceptical? What have you found works? What have you found is a good way of talking about faith and talking specifically about Jesus with people who may not be interested or even people who might be hostile?
Well, the men in the pub group that I run is an interesting thing. I 20 years ago, I started it after doing a couple of alpha courses, which I'd ran with some friends. And they were fun, those alpha courses. We invited some of our friends, which was a dangerous thing to do. But after doing those, a couple of my friends who came, who'd not made the commitment, if you like, were still intrigued and wanted to keep the conversation going, but they just didn't want to come to church. So I thought, well, how can I meet those people? And I had a sort of almost audible direction, really, which was just to meet in a pub once a fortnight, once a month, with a bunch of people, in this case, guys, read something from scripture, don't over-prepare, drink beer first, and then discuss it. And that group still runs. I mean, we're about 17, 18 guys. And that is one way of talking about it. Yes. But then you might, as a group, as we've been, you know, go and feed the homeless, you know, at All Saints Church, which is part of this glass door program, which converts churches into hostels for the homeless and feeds them. You know, that's, you don't need to say anything, you know, you just turn up and that's what you do, because that's what faith looks like. Mm. So there are different ways of doing things. Years ago, I was asked to preach at my church at the Vineyard by John, my vicar, and I chose evangelism as a subject. And then the week that I was due to do this, I was coming back on the tube, and one of those preachers was screaming at people in the carriage, and I was so cross. And then it happened again in the same week, which is quite unusual. And again, I was just really cross. I think, what were you doing? You're not, who is this for? But I really, again, I felt a challenge. Well, how would you do it? Yeah. And I was preaching on the Sunday. So on the Friday, I went down to Hammersmith. I can't believe I'm telling you this, but I got on a train and I tried to preach on the train. I did three or four. It's the most awful things I've ever done. I don't recommend it. A friend of mine, my cousin actually, was there and asked me, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to go and preach on the tube. And he went to get his camera and he filmed it from a distance. So there's footage of me, which I've never seen, doing this. And what was interesting about it, when I preached on the Sunday, it really helped me talk about different ways of doing it.
Yes.
I'm not saying that's wrong that way.
Yeah.
It's just not my way. Yes. Or it's not the way I could do it.
I like what you said though about the challenge of, well, okay, that may not be the way of doing it, but how are you going to do it? And it reminds me of an old quote from an old preacher who was challenged on the way he evangelized. And he wrote back to this person complaining and said, you know, dear sir, you're quite correct. My method has its problems, but I like my way of doing it better than your way of not doing it. And it's that sense of, well, all right, you don't agree with that method, but what are you doing? Which is a challenging thought for sure. We've talked a lot about Thought for the Day, but I'm aware there's so much more to your work than just Thought for the Day. You've written fiction. I believe you wrote part of the BBC series Silent Witness, which was massively popular as well. So, big broad question, what's been the best day of your career and what's been the worst day?
Well, gosh, that's a really difficult one to answer. One of the sweetest moments of being a writer was the day I got a letter from an agent saying they wanted to represent me, having read my first novel, The Testimony of Taliesin Jones, back in 1994 or whenever it was. It's a very short letter. It said, "Dear Ridley, and I loved your book and I want to represent you." and it was from a top agent. And I was literally leaving to go on holiday that day, and I can't have had more better highs than that.
Yeah.
So that would be a high. There have been many joyous experiences through the different things I've written, books and film, and television too. The worst. That's harder to answer. I mean, there are my previous novel, The Aftermath, was made into a film, and I wasn't totally happy with the film. I mean, I contributed a script early before I wrote the book, but I didn't write the film itself. And the film actually wasn't as bad as some people have suggested. But there was a moment during that, actually at the premiere of the film, which was a wonderful event, where the sort of terrible review came in from Peter Bradshaw that night, because he was there. You know, it was all very, very quick, and that was such a sad stealing away of what should have been a lovely moment. And he was kind of, although I had my own criticisms of the film, I felt he was actually wrong and overly harsh about it. I mean, that wouldn't be the worst, but that's sort of example of, you have these strange different calibrations of what success is with writing.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, it's, do I get an agent? Then it's, will I get a publisher? Then it's, will anyone buy my book, or will it get good reviews? You know, or will people still read me in 10 years time or 100 years time? And, you know, where do I sit in the canon? And will I, you know, am I even, you know, you're in such a sort of, a competitive world, I guess, but also a sort of subjective world, and a world of where there's truly great art, you know, and so, you know, where you're never satisfied, you know,
yes.
Writers are never satisfied. So it's important to have those moments of real joy and gratitude.
When the days are harder and we all go through the hard days, what is it about your faith? How does your faith keep you going in the darker moments? If I were an atheist, were to say to you, you know, Ridian, you talk about Jesus and God and Christianity, but you know, what difference does that actually make to your life day to day, particularly on the hard days?
I think I do live with hope, and I live with a degree of gratitude, and I've got someone to thank, and I am conscious of God's presence. Not always. It gives life a sense of meaning, and a sense of purpose, and a sense of goodness and a rightness. It settles some of the angst, some of the questions that could eat away at you. In my case, I had a terrible fear of death before I came to faith, and that sort of existential panic, if you like. You know, and that felt like a very big question. And I sort of kept wondering why other people weren't asking the same question. Yeah. I mean, I still think that, actually, because, you know, it is still the big question, you know, why are we here? What happens when we die? So I think that coming to faith, that's an example of something that changed.
Mm. Do you think it's the case that now that we are arguably heading into another massive crisis with coronavirus, do you think it's the case that when things like that happen, it causes people more generally to ask the bigger questions that they may have just not considered because life was just going on as normal? And it's not until a major event happens like this, where lives are completely changed, that people start to ask the big questions. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Yes, I think it does do that. I mean, it's, you know, for some people, a lot of people live life without ever even thinking that they're going to die, you know, or that they are totally in control. So having those things confronted, you know, I mean, personally, I think people should work those things out a lot earlier in life than when a sort of huge disaster comes along. But that, you know, that is reality for a lot of people. Whether it changes them, you know, makes them turn to God. I mean, some people will be looking at this thing now and saying to me, well, where's your God when you know, where's God now, sort of issue. So you guess it works both ways. Mm. I think what's interesting about now is it's sort of so huge and seemingly universal that I think it will, I predict, it will fundamentally change a number of things, hopefully for the better. It may not all be for the better, but I think hopefully for the better, because I think you can already see, although people stockpiling in supermarkets is not a good example of this, but you could see a lot of social activity that's kind, thoughtful, selfless, and a lot of that is coming out. So that suggests to me people are looking for meaning. And there's I think it's Karl Barth, the theologian, when he talks about that passage in Romans where it talks about tribulation leading to perseverance, leading to character, Romans 5. He talks about that tribulation. It's not the tribulation that's good. It's about rejoicing even in tribulation. But you're not you don't rejoice in the tribulation, but it's what the tribulation shows you that matters. And what the tribulation shows people is what they value and what they love and what they don't need. And that is the reason to be hopeful, I think.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's a wonderful place to leave it. Many, many, many more thoughts on all things to do with God and the important things in life can be found in God Bothering. It's out now by Ridian Brook, published by SPCK. And do get yourself a copy. Ridian is holding the book up right now and showing it to me on the screen because we're video chatting. And it's a beautiful cover. Do check it out. God Bothering by Ridian Brook. But Ridian, for now, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Go well.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Profile podcast during these difficult, strange, and unprecedented times. I know those three words you've been hearing a lot of already, but they really are, aren't they? We are going to be carrying on putting out the Profile podcast each and every week. You'll be hearing a mixture of interviews we've had pre-recorded since before this crisis began. We'll also be slotting in some interviews very relevant to the moment we're in. So there'll be a mixture. It won't all be coronavirus-related content, but we will cover it as well. I've been Sam Hells. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you join us. If you have enjoyed the show, we would so appreciate it if you would give us a rating and a review wherever you found this. It helps others to discover the show. And the other thing I wanted to let you know before we go is that this show is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the UK's leading Christian publication. It's the magazine I have the great privilege of editing. And while many things have stopped because of this pandemic, our magazine has not stopped. We are still producing a monthly print product. It's a fantastic magazine, if I may say so myself. Why not subscribe? We've got a fantastic offer on at the moment where you can get the print magazine delivered to your door every month, and you can also get full online access for only £4.95 a month. It's a great offer. Less than £5 for full access to everything we're doing at Premier Christianity Magazine, both in print and online. If you want to take advantage of that offer, the place you need to go is premierchristianity.com. Just click on subscribe and we'll set you up with that subscription. Do hope you're keeping well at the moment and staying safe, and we will see you next time.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help. You save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.